Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. My name is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an anarchist or an independent anarchist press that is dedicated to publishing socially conscious literature. If you want to go to our website, xidraconis.org, to check out the books we publish. We published five so far. You can check out the books we published and order one. And we don't charge for books. We do accept donations. So if you want one of our books and you want to, you know, donate $5 or whatever, that'd be cool. We happily accept donations. We are not angry in the least when you donate. With me today are the two other editors of Kai Draconis Books, Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. And, you know, I've got some excellent news. So for a little bit of time, I was really worried that we weren't going to be able to continue publishing books because, you know, it's kind of expensive and we don't really recoup a lot of our losses, giving away books for free and only taking donations. But
you would have thought that would be a killer business model, but
yeah, right, exactly. After asking Chris and Hans to come on as editors to help me pay to publish the books, but also to help me select which works we publish and do some other behind-the-scenes stuff, they agreed to come on. So I'm really happy about that, and I'm glad to announce it on the podcast. So that's the exciting news. Today we are going to talk about Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility, which was my pick. You know, it is, you know, it's if you wanted to give like a bare summary of Sense and Sensibility, it could probably actually function for all of Jane Austen's novels. You know, heroine who has some difficulties, either monetarily or otherwise, you know, ends up after some trials and tribulations with a husband she loves. Is kind of the basic narrative arc of all six of her novels.
A husband she loves, but, and also reasonable financial security, if not great wealth, though occasionally great wealth. I mean the
right, exactly.
The inevitably the money is very tied to the resolution in one
right,
way or
absolutely.
Another.
And Hans, you just said, you know, the ending is often tied to some kind of economic well-being.
Right. I mean, it has to be ultimately, right? I mean, because marriage
right.
and marriage and economic transaction, I mean, to some extent, those things are still in some instances tied together. It's not unique to that society, but the way that the characters in the environment that Jane Austen writes about, I mean, the way that they conceive of marriage, inevitably there's a question of if for no other reason than because women don't really have any other way of obtaining an income other than inheritance or marriage, inevitably there's the question of how am I going to provide for myself built into the question of how will I marry, right? Can I find a mate that provides both you know, personal satisfaction, emotional satisfaction, and also some reasonable amount of financial security.
Right, right. And the only real exception to that is the novel Emma, in which the heroine is actually already kind of set up for life from an inheritance. So that's one of the few, that's the only novel in which the heroine's like monetary security doesn't hinge on the match at mm-hmm. the end of the at the end of the book. And actually to my mind it's not the weakest of her novels, but it's, you know, I don't like it as much as Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, or Persuasion, though I do think it's probably better than Mansfield Park or Northanger Abbey. And I'd say the economic problem features prominently in both Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, and in Persuasion, and in Mansfield Park. I don't quite remember Northanger Abbey as much, but
so it's interesting to me, Patrick. And maybe this will give you an opportunity to kind of talk about the things that you picked, the reasons you picked this. But it actually is interesting to me that you're enough of a Jane Austen fan to have read all of her novels. It surprises me that you'd be so acquainted with them all as to be able to compare them with relative ease like that, and you know, to have an opinion about which is best, which is worst. If for no other, not, and I say that not out of any kind of, I mean, I have plenty of respect for Jane Austen, but I mean, I can't think of, just in general, I can't think of very many 19th century authors that I've read the majority of their body of work, frankly. Or you know, at this point, many authors, period, that aren't on my list of all-time favorites. So what is it about Jane Austen's work that you found appealing enough to go through the lot of it like that? And based on that knowledge of the whole body, why was it that you picked Sense and Sensibility as particularly representative or particularly thought-provoking?
Well, okay, so there's probably a few different reasons why I'm a huge Jane Austen fan. You know, to go through some of the lesser reasons, she's a British author, and I don't know what it is, but the British voice I just really like.
Mm-hmm.
I really prefer it to the American voice. I don't know why that is. Most of the authors I really like tend to be British. So, you know, Jane Austen and George Orwell are two very, very high up there authors for me. And there's something about the voice that I really dig.
Sure.
And Thomas Hardy. Thomas Hardy, I also, you know, think is great. You know, and you mentioned in one of our social media chats the element of fantasy. I don't know how much of that actually comes from Austen herself.
Right.
You know, well, there's definitely an element of fantasy in her novels, but there's also her own acknowledgement, especially in Pride and Prejudice, that it is a fantasy, that it's not really real. But, you know, that element of fantasy is pretty engaging just on a story level,
and
so I like that.
And when when I said the element of fantasy in the chat, just to clarify, what I was thinking of was, and I do think you're right in saying that it's almost totally external to Austen, right? Like when Jane Austen's books are adapted for film, there's almost always an emphasis on lavish production design, right? And so I think that probably has creeped into some extent. I guess, like, because there's the emphasis on lavish production design, and that emphasis is based on kind of our, like, what's most alien, I think, about Jane Austen's works is the sort of shelteredness of the life that all these people live, right? They're in these big lavish estates in, you know, these beautiful country houses, and in fact, I mean, I think that the actual novels are very focused on the sort of social insecurity created by the need to try to maintain that lifestyle. But the perception I think that a lot of people have, and maybe I'm just taking my own perception and projecting it on a lot of other people, right? But even though the novels themselves are probably they tend to be very focused on the insecurity based around the need to maintain that, the perception of the pleasures of the novels, or more so the adaptations, is the enjoyment of the fantasy of having that thing, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that's probably one instance where there's some, I guess, like the thing that I kept coming back to, there's a thought that I kept having reading this in particular, right? Which is that, like, and this is why I wanted to do The French Lieutenant's Woman for the next podcast, is because I'd never really thought until reading Sense and Sensibility now, I had never really thought about how completely and totally restrictive this world would be to live in, right? This world,
right,
meaning upper class British society in this particular period of time. There's so many things that these people are unable to do in the normal round of their day-to-day life that we would take for granted. There's a kind of deeply, deeply restrictive social micromanagement of
right,
things like, and it, maybe to some extent I was more aware of it because the version that I read is very extensively annotated, and many of the annotations have to do with providing a social context for why, for instance, calling an unmarried woman by her first name would be presumptuous, or why just emphasizing that, you know, unmarried men and women did not write each other letters unless they were engaged or, you know, about to be engaged, right? So there,
right,
there are all these little, I think on this read, I was just really struck by how, so I've mentioned The French Lieutenant's Woman, and The French Lieutenant's Woman, we'll talk about this next week, but to some extent it kind of makes the case that this is a form of a totalitarian society, right? And the totalitarianism isn't coming from government control. It's coming from this mixture of the drive for economic status, the drive, like the materialistic urge, and the ways that the ability to obtain financial security and position are connected to esteem. And then, of course, group esteem is based on these very, very, very particular and restrictive sets of rituals, right? So it's the level of it's nightmarish, really, in some way. To live in this society would to us be nightmarish. And I had never really thought about that before. And I guess, you know, you mentioned Thomas Hardy, and maybe this is, I don't know if this is what you're interested in talking about in choosing this book, but I having read this in relationship to Thomas Hardy, right? Thomas Hardy realizes that. Thomas Hardy understands, I think, the nightmarish restrictiveness of that, and fundamentally writes against it. And
right,
something like Sense and Sensibility, this is, it's more like a manual on how to live in the society in a way that I don't think,
right,
is at all. I found myself a little bit more distanced from it than I would have been if I'd read it 5 years ago, because it's a manual about how to live in a totalitarian society, written by someone who doesn't really seem motivated to challenge or overturn that order, right? And I can't say, it's ridiculous to say, it's ridiculously anachronistic to say, well, I wish Jane Austen had thought more about why this was a shitty world to live in. You know, but it, and I think that's part of why it surprised me that you would be as much into Jane Austen as you are, right? Because it would seem like your natural sympathies would lie more with something like Thomas Hardy, where you have a dissection of the moral and social order from someone who in a lot of ways has a relatively contemporary set of values, right? But I'm wondering if there's a subversiveness or a critique in Austen that maybe I was missing in my own reading, at least of Sense and Sensibility, right?
So I think to respond, I would say I feel like you're maybe missing out on how critical she actually is of the worldview she finds herself in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this may be related to this idea of stoicism versus romanticism.
Okay.
Because we can get into this in more detail as we talk specifically about comparing Eleanor and Marianne, But I definitely think this novel is one in which Austin is setting up two different worldviews, Stoicism versus Romanticism, and she comes down upon the side of Stoicism.
Sure.
You know, so I think she comes down on the side of Stoicism, and because she, I mean, I'm not going to say that she's a Stoic in the same sense that, like, Seneca is a Stoic.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that because she's a Stoic, she maybe affects a stiff upper lip British persona.
Mm.
That, which is to say, she understates things.
Right.
So I think that in the depth of her examination of how problematic these economic relationships are, there's something very radical in that.
Okay.
But I think that it may come across as less obvious or less strong.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this kind of stiff upper lip or stoic persona that she adopted as an author. So that's kind of what I would respond, and I would say that I think she is deeply concerned about economic issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that maybe you're not thinking that she is as radical as she really is. Now, granted, I don't want to go too far and say that she's more radical than she really is.
Right.
I do think that she is a part of her culture, and so there's some level at which she accepts these things. And maybe doesn't go as far as she could have. Maybe she doesn't go as far as, say, Thomas Hardy would. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I think that her level of criticism of, you know, the economic absurdities of her and of how economy and or how capital and interpersonal relationships are so closely connected, I think she's very critical of that.
Sure.
And maybe she's not as vocal as, say, Hardy was, but I still think she's pretty vocal about it.
Okay.
To make a, if that makes sense. I feel like I kind of over-explained it, but...
Yeah, it does make sense. And I mean, you know, you have the advantage of more familiarity with her work than I do. I guess it's easy to confuse, let's say, Stoicism and acceptance, right?
Absolutely.
The, you know, Eleanor behaves in this way where she consistently represses her feelings. She acts with great consideration. She is not spontaneous, and eventually her reward for that is to get what she wants, right? And it's hard, right. I guess, to. I mean, Eleanor very carefully conforms to the norms of her time, and her reward for that is she gets a classically happy ending, and.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, but it's hard not to read that to some extent. Well, only 250 pounds, to be fair. Though she's, you know, living right next door to her immensely wealthy sister.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I don't think that she's, you know, she's getting a meager living by the standards of her society, but I don't think that she's in any material danger or insecurity.
By the terms of her elevated society. I mean, like, she's 250 pounds,
right,
affords
right.
her servants and all of that, but yes.
I mean, she's still earning more than, she's still in maybe the top 5% of all British society, just, you know, numerically.
Yeah.
Right.
She's just not lavishly wealthy. But yeah, no, and I think that the, I guess maybe because of the understatedness that you point to, Patrick, my response as a, my thought as a reader was that this was, if not an endorsement of, and I think I was less concerned in reading it. I was thinking a little bit less about the economics of it and more about the social restrictiveness of it, right? That her, you know, she conforms very scrupulously to the norms of total social restriction and self-suppression, and that is, and she's rewarded for that. And I guess there's, how much is that an endorsement of those norms versus, you know, a stoic recognition that those things inevitably are the water that those people swim in, and, you know, will be. They're there whether we want them or not, so we might as well play along, right?
Right. I mean, if I go ahead, Chris. I've talked a lot. You haven't talked at all.
Well, I'll just say, like, I feel like it'd be kind of useful to sort of separate maybe the social restrictions from the economic restrictions might be the wrong word, but sort of the economic environment. And in particular, how that relates to, like, the powers of the different sexes to exercise agency in that economic environment. So, like, if we think about, like, the economics as separate, I kind of wonder if, like, the social restrictions almost are a more level playing field between the sexes as Jane Austen writes them. It seems like women in...
Yeah. Yeah,
these books have a lot of agency in that particular dimension. There's something, you know, like, it's not like Willoughby gets what he wants, and everyone is sort of subject to these rules. And I don't know that there is. I kind of feel like while there might be read some criticism of the economic particulars, I don't know if I could speak to anything that really criticizes the restrictions, the social restrictions, or all of the propriety and all the layers of propriety and all of the rites and rituals that sort of guide interactions, because those all provide hooks and threads that women have access to as well as men. And it just feels really like there's so many frickin' Dashwoods, but the mean Mrs. Dashwood. the mean Mrs. Dashwood.
It's a lot like Gilead in that, like, all the characters have a variation. There's like three people named John Dashwood, and then everybody else is Mr. or Miss Dashwood.
Yeah, exactly.
Or Mrs. Dashwood. Right. It's, yeah.
Well, I guess there's only two Mrs. Dashwoods.
Two.
But you know, she has agency over her husband in a very stark and clear way, and I get, there's other examples I guess I would point to, and it feels like that is something that actually is sort of equitable in at least this book.
And I think I do agree with you about that. I mean, and you're kind of taking a different, you're inverting the polarity of the thought, right? I mean, your thought is that this set of intense restrictions creates an equal level of, creates the opportunity for an equal level of autonomy, in the sense that men and women are both under this intense set of restrictions, and that creates a certain kind of level playing field. This is not based on a great historical understanding, and so, you know, it might be that if I were to do more scholarship, I would see that this is not an accurate description of the era. But it does seem like the obviously economic power was concentrated very deeply in male hands for the most part, although there are instances in this novel where women are using economic power toward a social end, right? Like Mrs. Ferrars, is very explicitly using the, she has control over where the inheritance goes, and she's very explicitly using that control as a cudgel to reward or punish the social actions of certain people, right? So I don't think that in all instances women were totally deprived of economic power, but certainly it's rare that they would have that. But it does, I do think I agree with you, Chris. I think that your perspective on it is that the men and the women have roughly equal agency within this hyper-restrictive social milieu. My reading at the time was, boy, like men and women are both very, you know, tightly chained by this set of social restrictions.
Yeah, and I guess I would modulate what I said by maybe pointing out the obvious. The penalty for the penalties, the amount of agency that you might have in this environment, in this very, very restrictive environment, you might be a little bit more level. But the penalties for for breaking the rules definitely seem like they're a lot harsher on women. So, for instance, Eliza and Willoughby, yeah, are a really good example, I think. And you know, the worry about the ruination of a woman and versus you know what, men are not ruined; they're the ruiners. So, like. So I think that it's important for me to point that out. I don't think that like it's fair in terms of the outcomes, but there is an allocation of power that I wonder if Jane Austen, I mean, it's hard, but if she were just sort of writing within this context, I wonder if she would think that women would have no power or would have less if these rules and restrictions didn't exist.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
I wonder, you know, to speak to the issue of Willoughby and Eliza, I wonder if Austen... So you mentioned, Chris, that, you know, women are definitely, you know, they're going to... When these restrictive social mores are broken, women are often going to take the brunt of the problem,
yes.
Right? So, you know, Willoughby ruins Eliza, but he gets to go on and get married. And we don't really have much idea of what happens to Eliza, other than we know she's under Colonel Brandon's care. So there's some sense, I get the sense that things are going to be okay with her, at least insofar as that her needs will, her economic and material needs will be taken care of.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not she will be able to kind of reenter society, I'm not sure about. But that is a question that, that's a question that I think. Or I think this little relationship, or Eliza herself, it definitely reflects on your perception, Hans. That boy, I wish Austen was more critical of these totalitarian social mores. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it seems to me that Austen treats Eliza more kindly than the society at large would, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like,
and I mean, to her credit, and I would even say to her credit that I feel like, with one significant exception, I feel like she generally treats these characters more kindly. Broadly speaking, I think she treats all these characters more kindly than a lot of other authors might, or than you know, the society would. I do, you know, when I was reading this, I kept thinking, because this was her first novel, right, other than some minor stuff that isn't really well read or broadly read.
Was it?
I believe it was. Yeah.
It's weird. Like, her three three considered her three best novels were written before her quote unquote three not as good novels, but
is
whatever.
This regarded as one of her better novels?
Yeah, the critics regard Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, and Emma as her three best. Then probably Persuasion, and then, you know, like a tie for not very good are Northanger Abbey and Mansfield Park, which, I found some to enjoy in all of them, but whatever.
Sure. Well, it just, there were some ways, early on especially, there are some ways in which some of the characters, or there are places where some of the characters felt a little bit like two and a half dimensional to me. Or where it seemed like they were making decisions that were more to advance the plot than, you know. The thing that jumped out, and maybe I'm being too harsh on this, but like the scene pretty early on in the novel where Fanny and Mr. Dashwood are having the conversation that sways his mind from caring for his sisters to cutting him loose, right? The way in which he completely shifts his perspective on his obligations in the space of a page, like that felt a little, that rang a bit hollow to me, right? And it's not an enormous criticism. Well, and other people might feel differently. It just it felt like something that had to happen to kind of set up the frame of the plot,
right?
You know, and I bring that criticism up only to counterbalance that by saying that I did admire the sympathy that she extends even toward characters like Willoughby that one assumes would have been, you know, unconditionally loathed by a lot of the broader society.
Right. And to mention, to kind of comment on this idea of, you know, John Dashwood and Fanny Dashwood, Fanny changing John's mind. There's an echo of this scene, and I made a note while I was listening to it, because Chris, you said you wanted to maybe do a recurring thing where we bring up our favorite line.
Yeah.
If you remember that. And, so Eleanor is talking to, Edward's brother, Robert Ferrars, and he's talking about, what's he talking about? He's talking about what he does. It's like some kind of like investment or whatnot. And he says a bunch of inane, stupid things, and Eleanor says something like, she agreed with him because she didn't think he deserved the compliment of rational argumentation.
That was one of my something favorite lines too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's a great line.
Yeah, I like that line a lot. And the reason why I think this scene echoes what you're talking about, Hans, between Fanny and John, is because I feel that she's definitely, Austin is definitely satirizing the anti-intellectualism of much of this landed or gentry class, and that's one part of like her economic commentary or economic criticism. So what I'm saying is I don't disagree with you. I think that that is kind of maybe two-dimensional characterization, like she's got to do it to move the plot forward. It's maybe, you know, a somewhat funny little interlude, but the characters don't feel well-rounded. And then the next few times we see John, like he's totally removed from their concerns, which is, you know, Eleanor, Marianne, and their mother, Mrs. Dashwood. They're trying to find economic security, and he's worried that he would have to liquidate a bunch of his stocks to buy this farm.
Your thought then is that maybe if some of the characters seem two-dimensional, that's a feature rather than a bug. That's rather than being an aesthetic failure, that's maybe more accurately read as something that Austin was doing deliberately to reflect the fact that she did in fact feel surrounded by two-dimensional people.
I wasn't necessarily thinking of it that way, but I definitely think that while we might say that they are two-dimensional characters, I think she's purposely making them seem flat because she wants to, you know, satirize this kind of gentried upper class that's anti-intellectual.
Well, I'm just thinking almost any of the more interesting characters in this book find themselves in some sort of uncertain place, or at least found themselves in an uncertain place. that includes the mm-hmm. male characters. But if, you know, Lucy Steele, who mm-hmm. I think is actually kind of interesting. I don't know if we have time to talk about her. I want to make sure
we talk about her. I want to talk about
her.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be good.
I have thoughts about her. But continue your thought.
Well, and
let's talk about her.
Well, just very quickly, like all of the interesting three-dimensional characters have, at least in the past, maybe before the novel, but Colonel Brandon talks about basically being kicked out of his family and only coming into his wealth when his brother died and not having, I guess, like an heir to pass it on to. But they're all interesting maybe because they have to pay attention in a way that people who just have it, you know, they have the wealth that will carry them through are allowed to mm-hmm. not think about those things, if that makes sense. And then almost all of them are a little bit two-dimensional.
That's fair.
The ones who just have it.
Yeah.
The ones who haven't had to experience real uncertainty or doubt or fear.
Yes.
They're rendered two-dimensional by their kind of fundamental. They're rendered two-dimensional by the fact of never having had to fight for anything.
Yes.
Yes. That's fair. But I wonder, so Lucy, I think that is an excellent point, and that does, I mean, that probably is a good way of converting some of what there are things that I had as aesthetic criticisms of the novel that you might actually be able to turn into arguments in its favor through that lens. I appreciate that. I wanted to talk about Lucy, I guess, because there was something about, and again, it might be an overreaction here, there was something about, so I had mentioned that Austin generally exercises a surprising amount of empathy toward most of the characters in the novel, and there was something about the disdain that the narrator seemed to have for Lucy that made me uncomfortable, right? Because partly, I think, because there's a sort of like class snobbery built into it that, I mean, for the most part, this is a work that is very... I mean, it seems to me to be generally as aware of and wary of class snobbery as you could reasonably expect something from that era to be, right? But there's a way that Lucy's, her poor grammar, her lack of education, her inarticulacy, the obviousness of how she conducts herself, those things are, there's just a certain kind of disgust that it has toward those qualities that made me a little bit uncomfortable, especially in relationship to the fact that, I mean, what does Lucy do fundamentally? She leverages, she consciously leverages the social conventions of the time to gain economic and social power, right?
Yes.
And it's difficult for me as an individual to find that blameworthy, right? But there is something about the way that Austin portrays her that seems, I'm a bit, I don't want to say disturbed by, because that's a bit much, but I feel like you could very, you know, if you wanted to do an interesting project, you could very easily retell this entire story from Lucy's perspective and make her a very sympathetic figure, I would say, right? And it surprised me that there wasn't more ambiguity in her kind of basic loathsomeness. And maybe that's a misreading, I don't know, but
that's interesting. I you know, certainly I think that you're right, the narrator does kind of have a contempt for Lucy. And you know, what is it about, and obviously I think that what you said, Hans, that, you know, you could take her and do it from her perspective, and a good writer would be able to make her empathetic, and I absolutely think that's true. And really I think I'm in agreement. I think that, like, I look at Lucy and she kind of seems shallow and not deeply intelligent, but you know, at the same time, she's in the same kind of precarious situation that Eleanor and Marianne are in, and the only difference is she seems to consciously be trying to better her situation through marriage. And there's definitely a contempt that the narrator has for that I don't quite understand. You know, even if she is shallow and, you know, not super intelligent, you know, which are not, you know, those are character traits that might not make you want to like her, but at the same time, you know, if she's trying to have some kind of security, you can't really blame her for that, right?
And the way that those manifest themselves seem to me to be rooted in, and to some extent I might be like, I don't know that I can recall details well enough to make a case for this, right? But her lack of intelligence, to a great extent, just kind of seems like a product of lack of education, right? She doesn't have access to education,
right.
and she doesn't, she's from low people, frankly. I mean, as I recall, she's someone who is trying to work her way into the upper class rather than being born in the upper class and kind of naturally manifesting the advantages of it. And
right.
And it just seems like there's a kind of unexamined disdain that the novel seems to have for the idea of somebody from a lower class consciously trying to you know, like the upper classes have this whole set of conventions. The lower classes, maybe to a great extent, don't. And this person from the lower class who doesn't really believe in those conventions is cynically using things such as Edward's total inability to betray his honor by breaking an engagement as a mechanism. And
right.
And that seems fine to me.
Well, I kind of, because like, she's made fun of by Edward is embarrassed by how poorly written her letters are, and people poke fun at her, but she's incredibly successful. She's like really good at playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder, I don't know if there's like an unreliable, you know, sort of like point of view aspect to this or not. But I wonder, maybe she is someone that we're not supposed to, well, we're supposed to root against her, but I do wonder about like how much like we are actually sort of underestimating her agency and her awareness, and you know, like she, you know, just because she exhibits all of these things. And I think that, you know, like what you're concerned about, Hans, is is maybe Jane Austen buying into an easy to grab trope to kind of like turn her into more quickly into someone that we're meant to like loathe as readers by like sort of painting her as like a bumpkin But
right.
But sort of coinciding with that is the is a criticism of the of I guess like the game that she's choosing to play, and that she plays very well. And at the end, it's you know, I guess her and I think it's her and Fanny are supposed to be best friends now. And
Mrs. Ferrars, I think.
Oh, okay, Mrs. Ferrars.
Edward's mother, I think.
Yeah. I conflated them. Edward's mother. So there is something about...
Understandably, because they are very similar.
Yeah. They're both... Lucy is someone who... I wonder how much we are actually led to underestimate. Maybe not intentionally. I don't know if that's like authorial intent or not, or whether we're. But I did at the end, Hans. I wanted her to think of her. I was sort of frustrated. I kind of wanted to think of her as a mirror of Eleanor, but someone who was more ruthless. And that's not really what we're given. But at the end, you know, in her letter when she, you know, says I'm releasing you, Edward, because your heart belongs to another. I wanted to understand what was behind her and her motivations there. Certainly not really concerned for Edward, but really wanting to play the game and win the game. But I'm with you and kind of wondering about what Austin was doing with her. And I don't know if I understand. Maybe if I knew the books as well as Patrick does her other works, I'd be more ready to wonder about that.
You guys, have you all read Vanity Fair? You were both in Rich's Victorian lit class, right? We read Vanity Fair in that. She's a bit of a Becky Sharp, right?
I was not.
Oh, okay. Have you read Vanity Fair, Patrick?
No, I haven't. But that's all right. Go on.
Well, I don't have a whole lot to say beyond just saying that she's rather quite a bit of a Becky Sharp character. But I mean, Becky Sharp, I can't remember who it is that wrote Vanity Fair.
Trollope?
Is that Trollope? Yeah, that sounds right. Trollope has this kind of perverse fondness for Becky Sharp, right? Or like writes with a certain kind of grudging admiration for her, for the success and the ease of her, not the ease, but for the success and the wiliness of her scheming. And I just can't help wishing that Jane Austen were a little more sympathetic to her Becky Sharp. Though I guess the other side of that is the fact that Lucy does get everything that she wants. I mean, I guess it's hard maybe to be too concerned about the novel's disdain for her when it does reward her, right? It's not like she has an unhappy ending. And I suppose the commonality that it creates between her and Mrs. Ferrars does suggest, that extends the critique of shallow socialites like Mrs. Ferrars. So it is used in a at least thematically effective way.
Yeah, it's super interesting. You know, you brought up some hard questions, Hans. I definitely. Just to kind of circle back and maybe summarize a little bit, I definitely see what you're saying about Austin not seeming to accept many of the social restrictions of her time without, you know, too loud a revolt. And I feel like, you know, for example, Edward's, you know, we're supposed to think of Edward as a person with integrity and honor because he doesn't break off his engagement to Lucy.
Yeah.
And, you know, today.
Yeah, that doesn't age well.
We'd be like, yeah. What are you?
It really does not age well.
Yeah, that doesn't age well.
Well, and it's like. And like, it's worth noting, I think, from the footnotes pointed out that he could be exposed to a lawsuit for that. Although, to be fair, the fact that it's been kept totally secret suggests that maybe Lucy would have a very difficult time with the lawsuit. I bring the lawsuit matter up not so much to, I mean, you know, not so much to say, well, probably he just kept it going because he didn't want to get sued, as it's not that so much, right? I don't think that he was worried about the lawsuit, but it does suggest the depth of that, the depth and the power of that norm. Although, I mean, your point that it ultimately would be better for. It ultimately would be better for the happiness of all the characters concerned if he were able to say, you know what, Lucy, I just don't love you anymore. I don't think that we will be happy in our marriage, and perhaps you could go social climb somewhere else, right? Like, it is true that that hasn't aged, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't aged super well, and I'm just trying to, you know, being biased in favor of Austin, I'm trying to think of ways in which, you know, she shows some awareness of the problematic nature of the social restrictions. And it just seems like, go on.
I guess you can make the argument too. And I say this having come into the podcast as someone who, you know, had that objection. I'm arguing the countering point now, but like, the marriage restriction in particular, one of the things that we have said is that one of the points that we've made, and I think, Chris, you were the first to articulate this, is that the equal ground created by the deeply, deeply restrictive social mores, one thing that does is create potentially a way of somewhat offsetting the economic disadvantages and the lack of economic autonomy for women, right? So if women are given this lack of economic autonomy, the other side of that coin is that the something like the promise of a man to marry a woman has such significant, such remarkable pull and power, and that there's a form of, even though obviously that's not an ideal way of balancing or, you know, it's not an ideal way of balancing that, but it is in some sense a way of offsetting that lack of economic autonomy. So if it seems like Austin is inadequately critical of that norm, obviously, you know, we don't want to live under that norm. If we did, I would still be married to my terrible college girlfriend, right? But like, but we don't want to live under that norm, but it's hard to blame Austin for not being more critical of that norm when maybe in respecting that norm the way that she does, or encouraging respect of that norm the way that she does, glorifying a character for respecting that norm, I suppose to some extent she's highlighting the ways in which that norm had to exist as a way to counter the lack of economic autonomy.
Interesting.
I mean, ultimately, it's still, I don't know. I do think that I'm probably a lot more sympathetic now to the book and to Austin's work as maybe being more subversive or more critical than I gave it credit for. And I don't, you know, ultimately, how much can you expect something to, it's like if all the fiction being produced now, right, probably some narrow strip of it, of all the fiction being produced now, probably there's only a narrow strip of it that accurately will reflect that will happen to reflect all the social norms and values of 200 years in the future, right? And if somebody 200 years in the future were to say, well, the only good stuff you're producing now is that 5% that happens to align with whatever crazy thing people are going to think 200 years in the future, I would not find that... I would bristle at that argument. So I can't necessarily be too critical of this book for not being more. I can't be too critical of this book for not being more willing to, you know, smash the patriarchy, I guess. But I also can't there's a way that I was distanced from the work by the awareness of that, that I was not expecting to be as a reader. I don't know.
Sure. Super interesting. Super interesting. But as I told you, gentlemen, you know, I need to get off, need to stay more on time this time. So were there any last, you know, ideas that we wanted to make sure we voiced before signing off this time around?
I think I'm good. Chris?
I'm pretty good.
Cool. All right. Well, dear listeners, that was our discussion of Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility, which I thought we'd talk more about, you know, Stoicism versus Romanticism, and we ended up kind of moving away from that. But that being said, it was still pretty interesting, pretty enlightening. It shook my faith in Austen, and now I feel weird.
No.
But what can you do?
If this is any comfort, Patrick, one lens that we might use to look at The French Lieutenant's Woman is that it approaches perhaps the same question of Stoicism versus Romanticism and comes down in favor of Romanticism.
That's interesting.
I don't know if that's true or not, but ask yourself that question when you begin it, and
all right,
we can use that to frame next week.
All right, that sounds good. So, as you know, if you've been listening, we're going to do The French Lieutenant's Woman next time. I hope you've enjoyed our discussion of Sense and Sensibility. All right, gentlemen, as usual, awesome to talk to you. Catch up with you again in a couple weeks.